So welcome, instigators, to our third keynote speaker of the Anti-Poverty Rantin. For many of you, John Clark needs no introduction. John hails from Britain and immigrated to Canada in the 1970s. It didn't take him long to become politically involved. During the better part of the 1980s, John was involved with the London, Ontario Union of Unemployed, fighting to increase welfare rates under the then Liberal Peterson government by 25%. In 1989, in conjunction with unemployment movements in Toronto, Windsor, Sudbury, and Ottawa, John helped organize a series of marches to converge on the Ontario legislature. Marching over 250 miles, over 4,000 descended on Queen's Park, which at the time was the largest anti-poverty rally since the 1960s. Out of the combined efforts of many economically marginalized Ontarians, the idea was discussed to create an Ontario-wide anti-poverty coalition. John was nominated and elected as the first lead organizer. OCAP was born in 1990. This year, it celebrates its 20th anniversary and stands as the longest-running anti-poverty organization in the history of Canada. While OCAP has only occasionally lived up to its actual province-wide vision, many anti-poverty communities, including Kingston, has turned to them for advice, support, and example. OCAP has fought to maintain and increase welfare rates with NDP, Liberal, and Conservative governments. Their bread and butter continues to be casework that directly empowers those experiencing economic oppression. OCAP took a lead during the Days of Action in 1996 after Harris cut welfare rates by 21.6%, organizing demos and innovative protests. They have occupied provincial government leader offices, shut down Bay Street, defended squeegee kids on the streets and in the courts, fought evictions, and drawn attention to housing issues through numerous squats and tent cities, most famously the Pope Squat. Recently, their special diet campaign, ably presented yesterday by OCAP's own Lisa Schofield, has brought many new members to OCAP and has directly alleviated and assisted many welfare recipients across Canada to actually put decent nutritional food on the table. While John has been one of the few members of OCAP who has been present since its very first demo and casework, he never toots his own horn and humbly and passionately acknowledges that the work of OCAP is a collective effort born from many committed activists. As fellow OCAPper Gaetan Heroux has insisted, in line with anti-poverty and labor organizers from as far back as the 1930s, as OCAP confronts intransient police, unwelcoming welfare caseworkers and politicians, their rallying cry is, "We are all leaders here." OCAP's works, OCAP's understanding of leadership works on the basis of subsidiarity. That is, that decisions should always be made by those most affected by them. John's talk today on austerity and resistance, lessons from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, is an excellent sequel to Francis Fox Piven's impressive talk last night, sharing real possibilities of defiance and disruption to challenge Ontario's own austerity measures. I had the honor of talking to John and many other OCAPers several years ago about OCAP's desire to fight to win. While ever acknowledging that ordinary poor people only occasionally have the energy, strength, and confidence to confront an oppressive neoliberal capitalist environment, OCAP nonetheless, and I'm quoting John here, is, quote, driven by the very definite anti-capitalist outlook. If your system can't provide the basic necessities of life, then let it perish. That perspective has got to be a major influence on how you organize and how you conduct yourself, and to that extent, I think we have a very healthy perspective, but it also needs to be said that capitalism is bankrupt and needs to be replaced, and that you need to struggle uncompromisingly and in an intransient way. That is a good starting point, but it is also true that we also suffer from the period we live in terms of the very, very low ebb of any detailed analysis of what is happening in society and what needs to be done." End quote. It's a great pleasure to introduce John Clark, who will no doubt inspire us to think of creative and successful ways of producing detailed analysis and confront what needs to be done in this crucial and threatening age of austerity. Instigators, join me in a warm welcome for John Clark.
Thanks very much. And perhaps if I could just ask from the outset, how many people actually heard Francis Fox Piven last night who are here today? A fair number, and that's good, because I think there is some connection between the analysis of Piven and Cloud and some of the things that I wanted to talk about. It is true that next month we're going to be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the organisation, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP. And I thought, that being so, it would be good to spend a little bit of time scanning some of those years and trying to draw some conclusions about what we've done and some conclusions about what needs to be done in the period ahead based on that. And there are three considerations that you could draw from the writings of Francis Fox Piven and Richard A. Cloud that I think we should keep in mind and use as a kind of a background to what I'm saying. The first proposition is something that that they put forward in their book Poor People's Movements, in which they said that the chief way in which the poor can have political influence is through their ability to create crises by disrupting institutions. And that's something that we sort of took to heart in OCAP. We actually, I think, have had that on the wall a few times. And we've been doing it for a while before we came across the quote, I must say. But nonetheless, to us, it's a very, very fundamental proposition. And in what I'm going to talk about, we should keep in mind the extent to which we've succeeded and the extent to which we've failed in building that kind of a model. Because to us, it's the fundamental question. Unless you believe that governments are swayed by eloquent poor stakeholders who put forward searing depictions of their suffering and convince them of the error of their ways and make them do the right thing, and that hasn't happened yet, then you have to ask yourself, how can the poor have political influence? How can they have political power? And the truth is, we believe that they can do that precisely by using the power of collective action in a way that is disruptive and threatening. And that came out very clearly in what Francis was talking about last night. Secondly, I'd like to keep in mind the welfare system itself, the system of social assistance, of income support, of public assistance that exists in this province, because interacting with it and challenging it has been very, very fundamental. And it's perhaps the most important area of work that that we've engaged in consistently. And again, in Piven and Cloud, they put forward a basic perspective of what the welfare system is. Essentially, that it was that initially, as they established this social and economic system, their intention was to simply abandon people to destitution and starvation when they found themselves excluded from the workforce. But the price that they paid in social unrest and social dislocation was high enough that they became convinced that they needed to provide something to people. But they were always concerned to provide it in as meager and degrading a form as possible to ensure that it would not impede the flow into the lowest paying jobs on offer. And Piven and Cloud bring out in their writings the concept that was developed, as Francis said last night, by the English Poor Law Reform Commission of 1834 of less eligibility, of precisely making the system degrading and sub-poverty so as to ensure the supply of cheap labour. And obviously, we've been operating over the last 20 years in a political context where that driving down of wages and working conditions has been fundamental in the attack on the social assistance system has been linked to that. And the third consideration that Piven and Cloud raised that I think we should test OCAP in terms of is what is possible in normal times, whatever they are, in terms of mobilising poor people. Piven and Cloud study the 1930s, the unemployed movement of the 1930s, and they study the period of the 1960s, the upsurge that took place amongst poor people in the United States, linked to the ghetto rebellions of the 60s. And from their writings, it would be possible to I think, conclude that there is a very serious question about to what extent the poor can be mobilized outside of those exceptional and explosive times. And during the last 20 years, OCAP has been involved in trying to mobilize people, not in the depths of a Great Depression, and not in the midst of a ghetto uprising, but at more normal times. I don't know how normal the Mike Harris period was, but nonetheless, we haven't gone through that kind of a cataclysmic period. So I'm going to review OCAP's work and draw some conclusions without keeping those points in mind and perhaps return to them at the end. And as was pointed out at the beginning, we do come out of a challenge that was taken up in 1989 to the welfare system in the form of a march that there are no prizes for guessing that it was based on the traditions of the hunger marches of the 1930s. And we organised a march from Windsor, Sudbury and Ottawa that converged on the Ontario legislature. And it was, an impressive beginning in terms of a challenge to the system, and it created something of a political crisis for the government of the day. It attracted a completely unprecedented amount of mobilisation and attention, and it led to several significant reforms being introduced at the time. But what we didn't realise was that in that challenge to the Peterson government, we were dealing with essentially the last gasp of concession and compromise and providing anything. From that period on, we were doomed to fight through a 20-year period in which the attacks were mounting and were getting worse. And immediately after this march, the Liberals went down to defeat, and there was great hope in the election of an NDP government with Bob Rae at the helm. And they advanced an agenda for people. And they told us that they were going to end the need for food banks. And I remember when we marched on Queen's Park in an earlier period before OCAP was formed, and we had a petition calling for a 25% increase in social assistance rates. Bob Rae took the petition and he said, "I'm hesitant to sign this because, in my opinion, you're not asking for enough." And he also at that time made a remarkable speech in which he said that the politics of poverty are only the reverse side of the politics of wealth. I thought that was an enormously insightful comment, but unfortunately he neglected to mention which side he was on. We dealt with a very difficult period in OCAP's beginning years of dealing with a government that people had placed great hopes in, that people saw as an ally, but a government that nonetheless was moving in the opposite direction. And in those years, we began to gain some of the experiences that have stood us in good stead, albeit that we were working in a politically difficult context. One of the first actions I remember we were engaged in was the decision by the Rae government to hire hundreds of new welfare investigators, or welfare cops, as we referred to them. And it was a real beginning in terms of the notion of creating political crises through mobilising poor people affected by the decisions of government. I remember the minister of the day, a man by the name of Tony Sulipo, held a community forum in which he was going to raise the question of welfare abuse and the hiring of the welfare cops. And we descended on that meeting and we took it over, literally. We took over the stage and we announced that the meeting was now going to be a discussion of how to fight against the crackdown and how to stand up for the dignity of people on social assistance. And Sulipo fled the meeting and we took it over. And their campaign around welfare fraud sort of disintegrated from that point on. And so that kind of mobilizing in that context was the beginning of what was going to come. And also during that period, we began to put into effect something that has always been very, very fundamental to OCAP, and that is using methods of collective action, not simply around the broader issues, but to defend people in their individual situations, to defend people who are denied welfare, to defend people who are facing deportation, eviction, and these kinds of questions. We've come to refer to it as direct action casework. And we didn't invent it. You can read it about it in the 1930s. You can read about the way people organized in those days. But essentially, rather than go through the proper channels, we've used the technique of bringing mass delegations of poor people to the offices and to the places where those decisions get made. It has a very high rate of success, I must say, but it's also a way of actually cutting across the patterns of accommodation that they want to get you into, and actually mobilising people to struggle. I could give many, many examples of that kind of approach, but I'll give one because it speaks to the question of method. We had a man come to see us who was a worker who had been injured, but he'd been injured off the job, and he worked for a unionised plant. He'd been injured at home, but he was entitled, according to his collective agreement, to long-term disability, and he wasn't getting anything. And so we asked him what was happening with the union, and he said, well, there's nothing they seem to be able to do. So phoned up the business agent of the union, and he was a nice enough fella, but he just didn't really see that anything could be done. In fact, he was quite decent. He'd actually gone to the workplace and organised a collection to try to help the fellow, but he just didn't see that the refusal of the insurance company to do anything was anything that he could respond to. And the man was in a desperate situation. He'd lost his housing. His marriage had broken up. He'd attempt to kill himself by throwing himself off a bridge, and he'd survived the fall. And when he came to see us, he was still homeless. So we took 50 of our members and we went to this insurance company and we walked past their reception and we just went in and took over the boardroom of the place. And I remember this man came in, presumably some sort of executive, and he says, what on earth is going on here? You can't come into people's offices barging in, just demanding things. And I said, well, actually, we do it all the time. The case was dealt with. The man got his money, and actually, this business agent called me and said, well, they promised us the money, but it's not coming through. Do you think you could do anything? So we phoned them, and it was straightened out. The point I'm making in talking about the union is not to suggest that this trade union, with its thousands of members, with the strike weapon, with all the power at its disposal, was weak and we were strong. Actually, the reverse is true. They had the great strength. We didn't have the strength. But the point is that what strength we did have, we were ready to use. And that, I think, is the important question. The poor can't go on strike, and they certainly can't take their investments offshore. But they can mobilise in ways that have effect, that have an impact. So then this period of the Ray government came to an end, and as everyone knows, don't have to be a historian to know this, what followed was a regime that was, in the life of Ontario, fairly decisive, the Mike Harris regime, the Common Sense Revolution. And Harris came to power with a clear intention of engaging in a war on the poor. I must say, in fairness, that he didn't exactly conceal this from people ahead of time. And he went in, and welfare rates were cut massively. The effect was devastating. The number of people rendered homeless exploded. At the same time as he cut social assistance rates, he devastated the funding of the Ministry of Labour to ensure that such rights as people did have under the Employment Standards Act couldn't be enforced, and the attack was enormous. We responded to this with a belief that we had to mobilise strongly. we organized some initial first actions before the welfare cut took effect that saw, for us, an unprecedented mobilization of poor people. We were able to organize very large numbers of people, and we organized some quite powerful actions. One that I remember was a march on the Lieutenant Governor's house. Since he, on behalf of Her Majesty, was going to sign the welfare cut into effect, we thought it appropriate to go to his place, and he lived in Rosedale. So we organized a march from Regent Park, which people may know is a poor public housing project in Toronto, and we marched into Rosedale, wealthy neighborhood. And we were sitting on some research that a city councillor had provided to us, showing us that if you took the welfare cut as it would affect the people living in Regent Park, and you took the tax breaks that the people in Rosedale were going to receive, in effect, $1 million a month was going to be taken from Regent Park and given to Rosedale. That being the case, we thought it was a good place to go. And we mobilized, and it was an incredible experience. The place was, apart from a mass of cops, Rosedale was deserted. The lights were all out. People had left. There were private security guards on people's lawns. It was incredible. And we marched on this place. And the sense that people had of some power, of some ability to resist, was to us enormously important. And we and others started to challenge the Harris government. And for a time, there was a beginnings of a mobilization that could actually, I believe, have stopped what Harris was doing. The trade union started to mobilize the days of action, and community organizations participated enormously. And strikes actually occurred, citywide strikes and huge demonstrations that gave a glimpse of the kind of power that exists. It was possible to build something at that time that would be comparable to what occurred in France. It would have been possible to build something comparable to the movement that brought down the first Berlusconi government in Italy in the 1990s. But it's fair to say, I think, that those leading the thing were not ready for the implications of taking it that far, and the movement was called off. It was abandoned. But Harris, of course, didn't abandon his program. He continued to implement it. So as an organization, we found ourselves grappling with the question of how we could continue to mount an effective challenge. And we took up all kinds of struggles during that period. We recognized that what was going on from Ottawa with the abolition of the Canada Assistance Plan and other things was part of the whole process. So we organized two very, very powerful mass delegations of homeless people to the Parliament buildings in Ottawa that led to some confrontations with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and led to a strengthening of the movement amongst the homeless in the city of Toronto. We took up a whole series of direct action initiatives around shelter closings. When the Doctors' Hospital was closed, as a hospital, it had been promised as a shelter for homeless people, but they were abandoning those plans because of business pressure in the area. So we organized an occupation of the Doctors' Hospital with the demand that it be opened as a shelter. And despite the fact that we were taken out by the emergency task force, they nonetheless opened the place up as a shelter for homeless people. When the Senator restaurant in downtown Toronto demanded that the Salvation Army hostel next door to it be closed, and it was closed, we organized a picket of the Senator restaurant every day without fail, disrupting their business quite profoundly, until the Senator restaurant sent a letter to the city asking that the shelter be reopened, which it was. Those kinds of actions went on, and we built them during this period. It was also during this period that we began to organize a number of takeovers of empty buildings. 8890 Carlton, some apartment buildings close to Maple Leaf Gardens. We took those over twice, and they were transformed with federal funding into social housing. We organized a takeover of a building during a papal visit to Toronto that became known as the Pope Squat, and it survived as a homeless living place for some 3 months before it was broken up. And so we continued that resistance all through the period of the Harris years. We single-handedly were far from powerful enough and strong enough to stop the implementation of Harris's agenda of the common sense revolution. I'm not pretending for a moment that we were. But during that period, we actually grew in terms of being a force of resistance and did manage to place definite limits on what they were able to get away with in terms of the implementation of that agenda. I'd now like to talk then about what followed Harris, because I think that's for us now a very, very big question. At the time when the McGuinty government was elected, there was this strong sense that something kinder, gentler, and more approachable was going to be put in place. I think that was an ill-considered view of things. I think in terms of the implementation of the neoliberal agenda, it's fairly standard that they have a period of hard right onslaught followed by a regime that consolidates but allows the agenda to deepen. And I think that has been exactly what has happened under the McGuinty government, that the problem has gotten worse, people's poverty is deeper, there are more people going to food banks, there are more people being evicted, and yet this perennial belief that McGuinty is about to do something, is about to listen, is about to change things, is about to take positive steps, has been a real impediment to mobilization. So we, not believing in the mantra of constructive engagement, we looked for ways to mobilize against this government around the question of social assistance rates. And we tried a number of things. I remember we held a fairly large rally outside the condominium of the Minister of Community and Social Services. I remember we organised a fairly large and certainly very spirited demonstration at a Liberal fundraiser at a mansion in the north end of the city that suitably aggrieved them. And we carried on that fight by demanding that if this government was about change, they had to actually provide increases in social assistance. And we came up with this notion of a way in which we could perhaps dramatise that by taking a tiny down payment and presenting the government with the bill. So we went to a Loblaws in a suitably upscale neighbourhood, and we went in and we took out about $3,500 worth of groceries. Just walked out the door with these groceries. And then we went to a warehouse and we photographed everything. And then we went to a low-income neighbourhood and knocked on people's doors and said we had groceries if anybody wanted them. And everybody took them. And then the next day we went to McGuinty's office with an itemised list of everything we'd taken. And we said, we didn't pay for this, but we thought you should, because it's actually the first payment that you owe people, and you owe it to Loblaws. But don't worry too much. Galen Weston is, I think, the 45th richest human being on the face of the earth, so he's not going to be in a great crisis if you don't pay him right away. But you need to know we're starting to take this from you. So we recognise that while this was an important gesture, we probably weren't going to be able to organise people to go to Loblaws on a big enough scale to get the welfare increases necessary. And so we came across something else, and it's been spoken about at the workshop yesterday, but I'm going to go through it a little bit, and that was the special diet campaign. It was probably, in terms of what we materially achieved, was the biggest thing we've ever done as an organisation. But it was also very, very important from the standpoint of building a movement within communities, for reasons I'll elaborate on. But as everybody probably knows, the special diet is a benefit providing up to $250 a month for people if a medical provider deems it necessary. Now, of course, it had remained a fairly obscure provision, not accessed by too many people, and where people did try to access it, the welfare bureaucracies would just turn them away. But we said to ourselves, how about if we really promoted this and made people aware? How about if we brought together sympathetic medical providers and signed people up? And then once people put their applications in, we back them up with what we might describe as vigorous advocacy. And we did it. We started to do it. And it started to have a very, very definite effect. I think in that first year, 2005, we put something like 8,000 people through clinics that we organised directly in the city of Toronto, including one that took place on the lawns of Queen's Park that got people about $3 million worth of benefits. It had a real impact. It was enormously important. But what was really important about it as well was that it was something that people had to fight for. Because we were not wrong when we said that the welfare bureaucracy will try to find ways to deny people. People were denied in massive numbers. They were denied through a kind of a covert operation of improper denial that went on that characterises welfare all the time. But there were various decisions made to try to change the policies. The city of Toronto tried to, for a while, have a policy of not accepting anybody but doctors, that nurse practitioners and dietitians and midwives could no longer sign the form and all these kinds of things. And we had to break this down. And to do that, people had to mobilize. And we organized, during the course of that year, innumerable actions. Actions at welfare offices, ODSP offices. We took over the Minister of Community and Social Services office. We occupied the Mayor's office. We brought mass delegations to the head office of welfare at Metro Hall. People just in an unrelenting basis mobilised and fought for the special diet. It was the most community-driven initiative that you could imagine. And out of it, one of the most important gains I think that our organisation has made came. And that was an organisation linked to OCAP in Toronto's Somali community. There were hundreds and hundreds and thousands of Somali women who participated in the special diet campaign and came to be the spearhead of it. It was a remarkable mobilisation. In the Somali community, there are various reasons why I think they came to the fore. Canada is operated on the basis of not being the melting pot that exists south of the border, but being this mosaic where we celebrate our differences. And although some have more to celebrate than others, of course, but nonetheless, the idea of multiculturalism is that communities will be regulated through gatekeepers. And the Somali gatekeeper system is not in good shape. They have agencies that are overwhelmingly dominated by men who've been here a long time. And women who've come here who are living in poverty are not very sympathetic to those organisations. So the systems of control are quite weak. And the level of poverty and discrimination that people face in the Somali communities is probably at the extreme end of what people face. So for all those reasons, there was a restiveness and an anger in the Somali community that was incredible. And it led to this massive mobilization that to this day is one of the real gains of our organization. So the fight for the special diet continued, and it was, I think, perhaps the significance of it was enormous in terms of what it was able to win for people. How it played out in people's lives. Because right now, people on social assistance in this province have incomes that would require about a 55% increase to go back to where people were in 1994. A single person would need about a $300 a month increase in their income. So somebody getting $250 extra is perhaps getting a significant part back of what was taken away. And that is something that has driven the government into a frenzy. It's something that they don't like enormously. And it strikes to the real heart of what the welfare system is all about. Right now, one in six workers in the province of Ontario is working at or close to the minimum wage. From the standpoint of being able to build that Walmart economy, it is essential that the welfare system be as inadequate as it possibly can be. If people are able to feed their families and pay the rent and live with some level of dignity, their appetite for being super exploited starts to go down a little bit. And so they need to push that out. And so for that reason, the special diet campaign, which went from a program paying about $6 million a year to one paying $200 million a year, and that was accessed by one recipient in five in the province, has really challenged the whole neoliberal direction, has taken back perhaps 10% of what was taken away. And so going after it for them has been an enormous priority. And so all along, they fought to try and oppose the special diet campaign. And this year, it became clear, or by the end of last year, it became clear that they were very, very serious about doing this. The first thing they did was to go after one of the most dedicated and successful of the medical providers helping people get the special diet, Dr. Roland Wong, who was named by the Attorney General as the source of special diet applications for 20% of people getting the special diet benefit in the province of Ontario. And Roland was hit with a charge by the College of Physicians and Surgeons that by providing income to poor people so they could be healthy, he was guilty of incompetent medical diagnoses. And so they targeted him. Next, they sent memos out to all of the offices, all of the ODSP and welfare offices, essentially saying that if you disagree with the medical decisions of the medical provider who filled in the forms, you can reject the application. Somebody I heard in the workshop here before mentioned natural justice. The notion of having somebody who wouldn't know where to look in Grey's Anatomy making medical decisions and overturning medical decisions is outrageous, but it gives some level of the seriousness with which they've attacked this. And then, of course, in the budget, they announced that the special diet would be eliminated outright. People have challenged that, and we're very hopeful coming out of it that this attack is going to be responded to with a very, very serious mobilization. When people were being denied en masse earlier this year, hundreds of people, Somali women overwhelmingly, descended on the head office of welfare, about 300 people crammed onto the top floor of Metro Hall demanding their access to the special diet. People held demonstrations in a number of communities at MPP's offices. And we are now having discussions with the Canadian Union of Public Employees about working to set up raise the rates committees in different parts of the province. And so there is, I think, some real possibilities that this initial attack on the special diet is going to lead to an increased capacity for mobilization. So perhaps in looking over the years that OCAP has been operating, it might be good now just to check in terms of the three points I made about Piven and Cloud. First of all, the notion that the poor can win things through disruptive action. Well, I mean, false modesty aside, I think it's fair to say that OCAP has established a model of disruptive action and proven that while it may not be popular with certain people, that it certainly has succeeded in getting some level of results. We haven't been living in a period when it's been possible to build a mass movement of the poor, but the level of mobilization that we've had has involved thousands of people and has led to very definite concrete gains. We've been able to win repairs in public housing. We've been able to ensure that thousands of people who were going to be denied their benefits got their benefits. We were able to prevent people from being deported from the country. We were able to challenge evictions. We were able to force employers who weren't going to pay people to pay up their wages. That model of resistance has been created and does exist and is there as a resource for people to use and to build upon. And in terms of the cheap labour welfare system, the work that we've done, including and especially the special diet, has challenged and to a degree that is significant disrupted the erosion of social benefits in the province of Ontario. And lastly, the consideration of whether, at a time when there isn't a social explosion, whether significant and important long-term work of organising the poor can be done. I think OCAP has demonstrated that that is a possibility, that that can be done, and that can be continued. But now, and finally, I think we have to consider the period that we are entering into. Because if Piven and Cloud said that mass mobilisation of the poor was possible at an exceptional time of social explosion, I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to realise that that's exactly what we're dealing with at this particular point. We've been told for years, when we ask for funding for schools, healthcare, income support, when we ask for decent wages, when we ask that our water supplies be protected from danger, when we raise all kinds of questions about our fundamental needs, we were told that this was irresponsible and reckless, that this would lead to a deficit. And deficits are the worst thing that could possibly happen. Have you no respect for your children and your grandchildren? How dare you want decent income and these things? We've been told that. And then all of a sudden, a couple of years ago, banks and corporations started to run into trouble and go bankrupt. And all of a sudden, the printing presses just went crazy. They were just printing money. They were just racking up deficits. They didn't care. And they were giving money away to the corporate sector. And all of a sudden, again, deficits have become a problem. This reckless stimulation spending now has to be reined in. But they're not going to the banks and the corporations to get the money back. They're going to come to us. They're going to come to poor people. They're going to come to working people. They're going to say that paying public sector workers decent wages is an outrageous luxury that can't be afforded. They're going to say that that healthcare and education. They're going to say that welfare programs. All these things have to be massively curtailed. The special diet cut is devastating and it's vicious, but I believe very strongly it's only the first of the kind of measures that we're going to see. Francis Fox Piven last night spoke about some of the measures that have been taken in the United States. Time limits on welfare, on the receipt of welfare, denying single people access to any welfare programs whatsoever. Those kinds of measures have been taken in the United States, and I think it's the writing on the wall in terms of what we face here. So we're going to be dealing with a period of austerity. When the G20 came to town in Toronto a short while ago and established this billion-dollar armed camp, and they defended it by making the largest mass arrests in the history of Canada, up for discussion was their agenda of austerity, of cutting government deficits in half by 2013. That is a very, very serious agenda. The International Monetary Fund talks in terms of 20 years of austerity ahead for us. And it's not going to happen just in Ontario. It's going to be an international phenomenon. And I don't know if you follow things like this, but right now there are so many people on the streets and on strike in France that it's mind-boggling. Right now, Greece is a seething cauldron. Right now in Britain, cuts are being imposed on people that make the stuff Margaret Thatcher did look like sentimental nothing. There is going to be attacks coming down that are going to be brutal. And we should remember that when the G20 was meeting, it was the Harper government that was actually on the right-wing edge of that gathering, saying, enough of this namby-pamby stimulation spending, let's get back to cutting the deficits and attacking programs and attacking workers. So that's the future that we face. Now, OCAP's work over the last 20 years, I'm the last person to want to be dismissive of it, but it's been only a preliminary round in terms of what's going to be happening now. You're talking, having a conference here in Kingston, and you talk about instigating. I think there's an acute need in this period to instigate. We need to understand that we're not going to achieve things by putting forward reasoned, eloquent arguments about the suffering of poor people. We're going to have to mobilize people into a force that creates for the people in power a sufficient political crisis that they are forced to respond to that crisis. And that's what it's all about. And last night, Francis talked about some of the barriers that stand in the way. An image that stood out in my mind, because it resonates for anybody who's ever organised amongst poor people and in poor communities, was when the Great Depression hit in 1929, people were devastated by what they saw. And people didn't know how to deal with it. And initially they saw it as just a crisis in their own lives. They'd lost their jobs. They had no money. They couldn't feed their families. They didn't know what to do. And people tried to cover it up. People would walk around the block after they'd lost their jobs with their lunch bucket, trying to pretend that they were going to work so that their neighbours wouldn't know that they too were out of work, those kinds of things. But that kind of passivity and shame has its reverse side. You know, we have the possibility of building a movement that makes the stuff I've been describing only a bit of foundation digging. We have the capacity to do it. And it's not going to happen because people are all naturally radical in their thinking. If everybody was naturally radical, then there'd just be ongoing radicalism. Social explosions happen actually because people are deeply conservative, because people resist the need to act and to take change as long as they possibly can. They hope that somehow things will repair. And when they suddenly become convinced that they won't, that's when mass movements happen. But mass movements, we read about them in history and we think, oh my goodness, you know, a million people came on the streets. Isn't that incredible? And it is incredible. But the work that had gone on in the period before, the building in communities, the establishment of people who had leadership skills, who had something to offer, who could propose some kind of a lead, that was the prerequisite for that social explosion. And the work that we've been doing, the patient preparatory work that we've been doing, is a preparation for what's coming. They are going to try to take back from people their ability to survive. Everything that they had struggled for, everything that they had provided for their children, their very dignity. They're talking about imposing an inhuman agenda of austerity. And there is going to be resistance. There is going to be an explosion. And it's going to be a damn good thing that that explosion happens. And the important thing is that we do play the role of instigating. I'm proud of what OCAP has done, but I'm going to be a lot more proud of the movement that is going to rise up in this country and is going to be part of an international movement to say that we will not pay for this crisis. We demand a future, and we're ready to fight for it. Thank you very much.